Hello, I'm Tony Collins and this is the Rugby Reloaded podcast. Today my guest is Jeff Armstrong, the Australian journalist, author and publisher. Jeff has just published Volume 2 of his wonderful history of the St George Dragons Rugby League Club, The Spirit of the Red V, the follow-up to the first volume which was published last year in 2021. Jeff weaves together on and off-field dramas, interviews with former players and officials, the social history of Sydney, and his own knowledge and passion for the club to produce one of the best histories written of any sports club anywhere in the world, at least in my opinion. Our chat stretches across more than 100 years of St George history, and I hope you'll check out the details of how to order The Spirit of the Red V from my website at www.rugbyreloaded. So, without further ado, here's the interview. So, welcome to the show, Jeff. The first question I've got really goes back to the origins of the club itself, because certainly here from a British perspective, St George looms so large in the history of the Australian game that there's an assumption that they're obviously one of the founding members, but that's not actually the case, is it? They weren't one of the founding clubs in 1908. It took them a little longer to get into the New South Wales Rugby League.
They were almost a foundation member in 1908. St George then was certainly, it was on the outskirts of the city. It was basically rural. And there was an attempt to form a St George club in 1908. But the fact was that the St George Rugby Union team had only entered the Sydney competition in 1906. And there just wasn't enough players to go around. And so then there was a process between 1908 and 1920 where three or four times footballers in the St George district tried to join the Sydney Rugby League Premiership. But it wasn't until after the war, to 1921, that basically the St George case was undeniable. And so they came into the comp in 1921.
One of the things that you just hinted at there that's very interesting is, and again, from a British perspective, is that at that time, football clubs were very directly linked to a district, that you could only choose players that lived in your district. So the club from a very early stage was very much rooted in its local community, wasn't it?
Well, absolutely. Yeah, the residential rule was part of rugby league until 1959. But it's interesting. You can actually trace the evolution of Sydney through the rugby league clubs. Basically, you had the four compass points in 1908, plus Newtown, Glebe, Balmain, and I've lost the other one. There was eight. They were the inner city. Yeah. And then basically the competition, another inner city club, Annandale, joins in 1910. A Newcastle team, which made up the comp in 1908, they left to form their own competition. And gradually over the next century, as the city spread out, in the 30s, the eastern suburbs of Sydney became the place for middle-class families. So the eastern suburbs were the strongest club in the 30s. And then the St George district filled up similarly with middle-class families in the 40s and 50s. And St George became all powerful through the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, I think that's it. I agree with the point that you can trace the history of Sydney through rugby league. And I think one of the great things about the book is that obviously it's a book primarily about a rugby league club, but you've done it in such a way that it's also a history of the St George region of Sydney and to some extent to Sydney itself, because obviously the club's part of that competition. And as the district and the city grow, you can see that how that helps the growth of the club. And then later on, which we'll get to later in our chat, when the population starts to stagnate in the 1960s, that also has a big impact on St George. So, yeah, I said one of the things that I liked very much about the book was that you do get a sense not just of the club, but also of its community and also of Sydney and the game as a whole. I mean, was that your intention when writing it? Did you have the idea that it's going to be this panoramic look at the club in all its facets?
Absolutely. From the first time I went to Cogra to watch St George, and I didn't grow up in the St George district, but I felt like I was entering this very special place. And the pride in the district was one of the big things about St George. When I spoke to different people about what the book is titled, Spirit of the Red V, which goes back to the famous Red V that St George wears on its white jersey. And I asked what that was. And probably one of the best answers I got was from Dr. Jenny Saunders, who was a St George doctor through the 80s. And she talked about the pride in the district. And the players felt it, the fans felt it, the officials felt it. And it reinforced to me that a football club's not just about the players on the field. Obviously, they're a very, very important part of it. But a good football club is about the officials, the volunteers, the fans, every aspect. And I think St. George came to embody that. It's something that was there from the beginning, and the club officials from the late 20s on really took hold of it. And I think the formation of the Leagues Club in the 60s helped that. But it was the evolution of the footy club and of the district are one and the same.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that I love about the book, that you get a sense of almost it's written as if the club is it's like an organic entity. As you read through the book, you can see that it's growing, it's changing. There's a real life to the club and its community. And I think one of the problems that you often find when people write the histories of clubs is that they end up just being season by season by season. So you get, you know, basically one damn thing after another. And they're either very, very much concerned with the origins of the club, which is fair enough, or very recent history. But the rest of it tends to be just a slog through the seasons. Whereas I think reading Spirit of the Red V, you just get a sense of, although obviously you cover all the seasons and all the triumphs and disappointments that the club faced, it just reads like it's almost like an autobiography in a sense of a person, of how it's changed and responded to change and how it's just evolved over the past century and more. How long did it take you to actually write it? I mean, what was your intention when you initially started writing it? I mean, because the other thing is obviously there have been quite a few books on the history of St. George as well, so it's not like you're in uncharted territory.
In one sense, I've been writing the book all my life. I mean, I vividly remember the first time I saw St. George play. And I have been a sports nerd forever. And so going home and reading, you know, whether it be the Rugby League News or Ernie Christensen's annuals, anything I can get my hands on. But I spoke to Steve Edge, the great St. George captain of the late 70s, who then went to Parramatta, who is now back working at St. George. I spoke to him in about 2017. And said, I've been involved in sports publishing for 30 years. This is my dream to write this book. I never at any point expected that it would be two volumes. But the club was very supportive. And I quickly became very keen to not focus on the 11 premierships, because that has been done previously. But I really wanted to look at the early years of the club, and especially the period from the late 20s when Frank Birch became coach through to the 50s. With people like Neville Smith and Johnny Hall, and to try and work out what it was that ingrained that sense of winning in the club. And I found that came from a number of different areas. The connections with the Labor Party were important. The fact that the club was very fortunate in the early 40s to get a president by the name of Clem Madden, who was an extraordinary figure. I think he was a Labor Party operative who I think wanted to be Prime Minister, but he stood for the club presidency. He was only 30. He'd played some first grade with university a decade earlier. And I think the footy club got him from the moment he became club president. And he then devoted the next decade of his life to building the club up. And he became a really central figure. So people like Clem Madden, Neville Smith, Frank Birge meant that suddenly I'm writing too many words for one volume. And it became 4 years of my life to get the whole thing done. And volume two came out last month.
It's a great read as well, because, again, one of the problems with club histories or just general histories that cover a lot of time is that it tends to get a bit wearing as they go through the years and then the decades. But I think what you've done by combining all the interviews you've obviously done with people, as well as the archival research and your own passion for it, it's just a fantastic book. I'm not just saying this because you're doing the podcast, but it really is one of the best club histories in any code of football that I've read, because it has the, you know, the objectivity that you need when you're writing a history, but it also just covers everything about the club, whether it's on-field tactics, coaches, right through to the links with politicians in such an interesting way. It's, I couldn't recommend it more highly. One of the things that's interesting is that although St. George, when they joined the competition in 1921, although they were a strong side, it took them 20 years to win a premiership. Was that because of the strength of the other clubs in inner city Sydney, or was that because of just that they were a new club and it took them a long time to overcome the obvious issues that new clubs in the competition always have?
When Frank Burge, the great forward, came over as captain coach in 1927, he changed the club. He toughened them up. He taught them how to win, essentially. And they made the grand, they were wooden spooners in 1926, made the grand final in 1920, or the final in 1927. Should have won the comp in 1928, were very unlucky. Lost a semi-final in extra time when they were down a player. And then the Depression hit. And where the Depression hurt St. George, and actually hurt all clubs and made it the competition a little bit of a lottery, was that the best players could earn a living by coaching in the bush. And it's astonishing the number of very, very good St. George players in the early 30s who would play very well for one season and then head off to country towns where they could earn a few quid. And so St. George made the grand final in 1930, then had to rebuild their side, made it again in 1933. And they were, it just never quite happened for them. They also had, it's interesting, I was involved with Ian Heads and David Middleton in producing a history of the Roosters. And the Roosters were the dominant side right through the 30s, which in my view was because the eastern suburbs of Sydney was the place to live, which is a result of the Bondi Tram being built in immediately after the war. But the Roosters probably should nearly have won six or seven comps in a row, but they didn't. And I think there was a great uncertainty to football in Sydney in the 30s. And then St. George fell away a bit. There was a split with the Junior League in 1936 and they had to recover. But then another great St. George man, Neville Smith, came to the club in 1939. And he took, again, like Burge, took the team from the wooden spoon in 38 to the top of the table in 39. And then finally got them to their first premiership in 1941. And from 1941 right through to the 90s, St. George were essentially contenders just about every season.
Was it also the case that the club, and again, this is specific to Australian rugby league, it's something that British, neither rugby league nor soccer has any experience of. Was St. George affected by the entry of Canterbury Bankstown into the competition in the mid-1930s? Because Canterbury was a district that was next door to part of the St. George district as well. So did it take away part of their junior base?
It did take away quite a little of their junior base, but it was a very natural move. The Sydney was developing and the southern and southwestern suburbs of Sydney were growing. And the Canterbury Junior League had formed in 1922. And by the mid-30s, their claims to be a premiership club were irresistible. The university had been part of the competition since 1920. They were fading away. I think it probably hurt St. George a little in, say, when Canterbury came in, but I think they soon recovered and the competition was better for it. I think that evolution of clubs coming into the competition, it's a natural one. I mean, it hurt St. George again in 1967 when Cronulla came in. It's one of the reasons why the St. George Illawarra joint venture in 1999 was so logical, because the St. George area, from a demographics point of view, had shrunk through the 80s and 90s. But Canterbury hurt, but not as much as you would expect in one sense, because there were just so many young families living in that part of Sydney. It was a natural evolution.
Yeah, and I think obviously as the club started to get on more of a roll in the 1940s and they won the premiership in 49 when they beat South. And then obviously they went on to this fantastic run of 11 consecutive premierships, which, I mean, that was, as a kid growing up in England in the 60s and 70s, one of the things that any rugby league supporter knew about St. George was that they'd won more consecutive premierships than not only any rugby league club, but I think it was the case probably any other football club in any football code in the world at the time. So it was a phenomenal achievement to maintain that consistent level of success. To what extent was the basis for that provided by the actual district, the community itself? I mean, were there significant changes? I mean, did the population increase? Did it get a higher standard of living? What was the combination of sort of on-field football reasons and off-field community-based reasons that provided the basis for that fantastic run.
There was a bit of the area was a sporting district. It wasn't just in rugby league that St George was strong. The cricket club was strong. The rugby union club was strong. Sportsmen like Jack Brabham and Ken Rosewell came from the St George district. But it's also true St George had some very shrewd administrators, and one very important development was the formation of the Illawarra Leagues Club in Wollongong in, I think, about 1951, which was very successful. And the Illawarra League then used the proceeds of that club to try and sign some of Sydney's leading players. People like Clive Churchill and Les Cowie signed. Noel Pitting, the great St George fullback and captain, he was approached. And St George's response in 1952 was to build their own Leagues Club. And the St George Leagues Club over the next 20 years became the biggest Leagues Club in Sydney. And it did give St George a competitive advantage. So the combination of a district, a middle-class district with football posts dotted all over the district, plus a Leagues Club that gave them a competitive advantage, a little bit of luck, and just some really shrewd administrators who could identify talent and always seemed adept at when a great player was beginning to fade away, that another player stepped up to take his place. That's why they won 11 premierships in a row. You could look at it, they perhaps should have won in 1955 and 1967 as well. It was extraordinary.
And I think one of the things, and again, I think the book's great at this, one of the things you described so well is the way in which the club, during that run of success, was able to renew itself. To some extent, I mean, you think of in stock and Manchester United's fantastic run in the 90s and 2000s, it was down to basically the fact they had the same manager, Alec Ferguson, who could do the same thing again and again with a different team. But with St George, the coaching setup changed, the players changed quite dramatically over a period of time. Was that down to the astuteness of the administrators of the club? Because, and again, the book does pay a lot of attention to people like Frank Facer. What was it that held the club together over those 11 seasons?
I think there was an extraordinary spirit about the place. I think part of that was about winning. One of my favourite stories in volume one of the book is Peter Armstrong, who's no relation to me. He was the St George hooker who played mostly reserve grade. He was a reserve behind Ken Carney, patiently waited for when Carney retired. And as soon as Carney retired, St George signed Ian Walsh, the test hooker. And Armstrong was left in reserve grade. And when Armstrong finally, Ian Walsh broke his arm on the 63 Kangaroo Tour. So Armstrong stayed at St George and played in the 64 grand final and then sort of released to go to Newtown. And St George didn't want to let him go. And the matter went to head office, to the New South Wales Rugby League, who ruled in Armstrong's favour and he was able to leave. And as they walked out the door, Frank Facer said to Peter Armstrong, "No hard feelings, and will you still be coming to the fishing trip on Sunday?" The club had organised for the players to go out on a Sunday. And Peter Armstrong says, "Oh, absolutely, you bet, I'll be there." And there was a real spirit about the place. When I talk to people, like great players like Johnny King and Johnny Riley, they talk about all that. They talk about the discipline that coaches like Carney and Proven instilled in them, but also about the great camaraderie. And I think winning helps, obviously, to build camaraderie, but there is something about that St George spirit through that period that did set it apart from other clubs.
Speaking of Ken Carney, there's an English connection with that great St George team as well, because Ken Carney played for Leeds, where obviously he learnt a lot about the game, because originally he was a rugby union hooker. And then in the 60s, Dick Huddock came over, the great Cumbrian second rower. So there's always been not a dominant or necessarily influential trend, but the club's always had a little bit of an English connection. Obviously in the 70s, Harry Bath took over as coach when Harry Bath was a great Warrington forward in the 1950s. So there's been a little bit of an English connection for St George over the years, hasn't there?
There has. I mean, that goes. One thing I found interesting is in the 40s, in 1946, when the Indomitables made such an impression, and St George were coached that year by Herb Narva, and they reached the grand final. But St George then approached. They spoke to Joe Egan, they spoke to Frank Whitcomb and to White. There was three English forwards that they spoke to about coaching St George in 1946 47, and they were very, very close to getting that deal done. And then when Carney came to the club in 52, he had a huge influence. But I would argue that Bath had an equally huge influence. Bath has said often, I'm not quite sure if it's a fair comment, that essentially said that Australian football was almost backward in its play. It was just, bump and barge. But he taught the St. George players a lot of ball skills. And when he came back and coached St. George in the late 70s, he similarly, that English influence was very important. And Huddett was interesting. I mean, Huddett is one of there was a number of English forwards or English footballers who emigrated to Australia in the 60s, not because there were opportunities from a football point of view. It was just English people were emigrating to Australia through the 60s. I mean, my wife comes from Coventry. She came out with her family in 1970. And Dick Huddart, similarly with footballers like Dave Bolton, Roger Pearman was another, there's a number who came to Australia seeking an opportunity. When Facer heard that Dick Huddart was thinking of coming to Australia, he immediately set out to sign him because he knew how good Huddart was. I'm sure Huddart was part of the England team that beat St. George in 62. And a couple of the St. George players apparently said to Frank Facer, we don't need Dick Huddart because that would force Elton Rasmussen, a test footballer, back to reserve grade. And Facer's response was, which I think says something about St. George's financial advantage over the other clubs, we'd rather have Huddart running for us than against us. And so Huddart then came and was very, very successful in his first season, had an off year in 65, but then was one of St. George's best players in the last year of the 11 premierships. That English influence was important. And I know that St. George tried hard to sign Alan Hardesty after that, but weren't successful later in the 60s. Then that tradition of signing English players, other clubs sort of took over. They went very hard for Malcolm Reilly, but Reilly preferred to go to Manly, which I think probably reflects the fact that by the 70s, St. George had lost that financial advantage.
Conversely, from a British point of view, I was too young to see them play, but certainly from my father and grandfather, watching the Kangaroos come over to Britain in the 50s and 60s, the two players they always talked about were Johnny Raper and Reg Gasnier, as two of the greatest players that they'd ever seen. And so the impact that St. George had in Britain, I think, was also in the 1960s, was also huge, simply because of the greatness of the team. And they were obviously, Gasnier and Raper, were obviously central to the success of the club towards the end of its 11-year premiership run. What happened to end that run? Was it that the club ran out of steam, or that the competition had changed? Or was it just inevitable that obviously you can't go on winning at that level forever?
Yeah, that's true. They were very unlucky in 1967. Kevin Ryan wanted captain coach, and he wanted to go to Canterbury. And St. George, as was typical of their method in that time, then set out to sign the best front rower in Australia, who was John Wittenberg from Queensland. Wittenberg is almost a forgotten footballer, but he played every time he was available for a test match from 66 to 1970. He was selected. He was the best front rower in Australia. And the Queensland Rugby League wouldn't release him. And so St. George, with Ryan going to Canterbury as captain coach there and Wittenberg not coming to replace him, and Robin Goulet, who was St. George's other front rower in the 66 grand final, St. George went into the 67 season without a front-grade front rower. And that left them with a weakness. And even so, they were minor premiers, and they lost narrowly to South in the major semi-final and then lost famously by a point to Canterbury in the final. Facer then went on a spending spree in 1968. He signed Tony Branson, the Kangaroo 5'8", Phil Hawthorne, the great Wallaby. Wittenberg joined the club. Apisai Toga came from Featherstone Rovers, I think.
Yeah.
And St. George could well have won in 68, but it was a World Cup year. And St. George had seven players in the Australian World Cup squad. And then injuries hit them at the end of the year. And then it was interesting for the next four or five years, St. George could have won any one of those premierships, but they had a little bit of luck early during the 11 years. They didn't have much luck in those years afterwards. But by the mid 70s, St. George was not, the Leagues Club was not the powerhouse that it once been. And St. George were, while still one of the leading clubs, They weren't the juggernaut they'd been in the 60s.
One of the things I thought was interesting in the book was the discussion on the switch to four tackles, which happened in, 66 in England and then I think 67 season in Australia. The move away from unlimited tackles. And I think there's some really interesting things in the book. There's obviously the myth that the four tackle rule was introduced to stop St. George from winning, which is obviously not true because the four tackle rule actually came from England. But it's clear that that had a massive impact on the club. And as you document in volume two, the club was opposed to it. And there's an ongoing debate throughout the late 60s and early 70s about limited tackle football, and really until six tackles is brought in, and which pretty much resolves the issue. One of the things that I thought was interesting was somebody from St. George, certainly at one of the New South Wales Rugby League AGM, somebody says the problem with the four tackle rule is that it's ruining forward play. And I've often thought, and I was talking about this on to some St. George supporters on a kangaroo tour on Friday, that the introduction of the four tackle actually impacted on the British game, because the British international game, anyway, the Lions always base their tactics on traditional strong forwards and forwards who could offload in the tackle. Once unlimited tackle came in, that type of game that was based on the forwards could no longer be played. So, it's another thing I think the book does really well about. It manages to talk about, you know, everything from social and cultural issues about the game all the way down to tactics and rule changes in a really authoritative way. Have you any thoughts on the limited tackle on the move to limited tackle football? Was it really that decisive for St. George?
Well, what happened, as I understand it, Bill Fallowfield was the driver of that in England, and I think the four tackle rule in England was introduced or became a part of the game in December 66, and so the New South Wales Rugby League decided to trial it in the pre-season in 67. And it was very successful. The football played in that pre-season was very entertaining. And so I think it was passed by something like 36 votes to 5 or something like that, don't quote me. And the St. George delegates were advised by their board they could vote as they saw fit. And Frank Facer, who was one of the delegates, voted for the four-tackle rule. And Len Kelly, the club president, actually moved an amendment for six tackles, which was defeated. So four tackle rule became the thing. No one at any stage suggested that this rule was brought in to hinder St. George. And in fact, if you look at the St. George team that year with names like Gasney, Araper, Billy Smith, Graham Langlands, Johnny King, and the test hooker, Ian Wiles, Johnny, you know, they were probably better equipped for four tackle football than any other club. But what hurt them was the lack of front row forwards. What was interesting though, St. George went through a period in the early 70s, which when Jack Gibson coached the club for 2 years, where they quite clearly came to the conclusion that in limited tackle football, as you said, the big front rowers weren't essential. The St. George forward pack that made the grand final in 1971 was very, very small compared to the South side, who only narrowly beat them. And so through the early 70s, St. George often had second rowers playing front row, and the team did fall away. And it wasn't until 1975 when big Henry Tartner, a big front rower, came to the club. And St. George then went from eighth to the grand final. And then in 1977, Craig Young came to the club, who's probably the greatest front rower in the club's history. And St. George then won two premierships in 3 years. And so there was, I think there's been this myth in football that front rowers somehow limited tackle football. It does diminish the importance of front rowers. But I still think they're crucial. I actually think that was demonstrated in the recent World Cup. I think the only weakness Australia had was their front row wasn't all that powerful. And that's what kept made New Zealand get very, very close to them in the semi-final, was that New Zealand had the superior front row. I think that the St. George story demonstrates the value of front rowers, I think, as well as any rugby league story.
Yeah, so we mentioned Harry Bath before as one of the illustrious list of St. George coaches. And it was Harry Bath that played a massive role in restoring the club's fortunes in the 1970s. What role did Harry play?
he was essentially the perfect man for the time. St. George, Graham Langlands had coached the club from 72 to 76. And while I'm sure Langlands is clearly one of the greatest players in rugby league history, forget about St. George history, just a phenomenal footballer.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not sure he was the greatest coach in the world. He certainly wasn't great at encouraging young players. Then Harry Bath arrived in 1977 when St. George had a very, very young, but a very, very gifted side. And he was the perfect man. And what he taught that team, especially the forwards, forwards like Craig Young, Robert Stone, Rod Reddy, what he taught them, he built them into a real machine. And he also got, in that great season of 1977, he got the best out of Ted Goodman, who was a great fullback. And for one magic season, the team that became known as Bath Spades were just fantastic.
Yeah, and they played in the drawn grand final with Parramatta, which is another classic game. And I remember that was one of the first rugby league video cassettes you can actually buy. I remember getting that in the must have been mid 80s. But after Harry Bath left, it was actually a fallow period for a long, long time for the club, wasn't it? I mean, there was the era under Roy Masters, but the club never returned to the heights that it achieved in the 50s and 60s. And one of the things you look at in the book is the way in which St. George's, the district, had changed as well. And as you mentioned before, obviously Cronulla had come in, and because they're in to the south of Sydney, that had taken away a chunk of St. George's district. But to what extent did demographic changes and, you know, just general changes in society in St. George have on the fortunes of the club in the 70s, 80s and 90s?
Well, the thing that happened, St. George's population from the 20s to the late 60s grew. It was growing year by year. And then you get a situation in 67 where the New South Wales Rugby League brings Cronulla and Penrith into the premiership. And by bringing Cronulla in, St. George loses half of its junior base. And gradually that meant they lost their supporter base as well, as the residents of the Cronulla Sutherland Shire support their local team. And at the same time, the population of the old St. George district stagnated. And if anything, it declined from the 60s to the 90s. And it also, immigration meant that, whereas the St. George district through into the 60s and 70s was very much Anglo-Saxon, it became a much more diverse district in the 70s and 80s. So the district was changing. Interestingly, the football club still actually went very, very well. They could easily have won two or three premierships in that time. I would argue that 84, 85 and 93, the St. George, with just a little bit of luck, could easily have won all three premierships. If I can be very parochial for a moment, they got dudded by the referee in the 1984 preliminary final against Parramatta. In 85, they made the grand final and won all three grades, won all three major semi-finals, won both lower grade grand finals and lost the first grade grand final by a point. Then the club had a couple of, four or five bad seasons, but Brian Smith came back from England to coach the team in 91 and got the team to the grand final in 92 and 93. So despite those demographic changes in the district and the junior league was shrinking, St. George remained one of the most competitive sides in the premiership. But then Super League came along and it was a devastating blow to the St. George story.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, because it was a traumatic period for the club. And one of the things that I didn't realise or fully appreciate until I read the book was the number of times that merger was discussed with different clubs. And it was almost, the club was faced with the prospect of merge or die.
That's true. And that's not true. That is true. And it's not just true of St. George. The concept behind Super League was there would be four Sydney sides in an elite competition. And for the Sydney teams in the old ARL Premiership, they had to look at linking up with another club in a super franchise. If Super League was to win the war, that's what they would have to do if they wanted to play in the elite comp. So St. George did, they had some discussions with Canterbury, Cronulla, who had the inside running on Super League, tried to convince them to get involved in a Southern Sydney franchise. St George certainly had merger talks with the Roosters in 1995, but they were aborted essentially by a fan uprising against the idea. Then when the ARL won the first court case, it looked like St George might survive. But then when the Super League won the second, or News Limited won the second court case, they were suddenly trying to convince St George to become the Melbourne Dragons or the Adelaide Dragons. And in the peace talks that eventuated, this horrible term criteria became a thing. And it was clear that St George would probably meet the criteria, but whether they had the financial power to survive, it just didn't look pretty. And so eventually they got into merger talk or joint venture talks with the Illawarra Steelers, and the St George Illawarra Dragons were born.
In many ways, it's one of the few club mergers that seem to have worked in as good a way as you could have hoped. I mean, not least, I remember talking to Steve Mascott about this, you know, an Illawarra supporter. And a lot of Illawarra supporters, you know, were fine with the idea because, you know, if you had to merge with anybody, why not the, you know, arguably the greatest club in the history of the Sydney competition? So it does seem, unlike some, obviously the Northern Eagles, to take the worst example, and even the West Tigers have had a lot of problems, but it does seem to have been a very successful coming together of the two clubs.
I think in global terms, there's not many examples in global sport of joint ventures succeeding. And I think for a joint venture to succeed, you do need both parties to enter the agreement with a lot of goodwill. And the reality was that the Illawarra Steelers were broke. They weren't going to survive on their own. And they needed a partner. St George also needed a partner because their junior base was so small. So it was a very... there was advantages for both sides. And the impression I get from talking to people at both clubs is that there were a lot of good people at both clubs. And so initially, at least, it was a it had the potential to be very, very successful. And I think for the first decade, while the Illawarra District was producing a number of really great footballers, people like Matt Cooper and Ben Hornby and Ben Cray, Brett Morris, Jason Riles, and the St George Leagues Club was providing most of the money and also producing footballers like Mark Gasnier and Jason Nightingale. The venture went very, very well. And then when Wayne Bennett came to the club, it became a powerhouse in the competition. It's fallen away since then with on-field results. But you'd have to argue that over the course of the 20 years, the joint venture has worked better than any other joint venture has worked, I think, globally.
Yeah, I think it's true. I think you're right. I think it's true that when you look around at merged clubs in other codes, they've also had a lot of problems. So yeah, it's probably the most successful merger of two clubs in any major football competition. But it does lead to one question that I know you feel strongly about, and I share your feelings about the way the records of the joint club are treated, because apparently, according to some official sources, St George Illawarra are a new club with no history.
I get very agitated, will I say, when people talk about that St George Illawarra, its history began in 1999. When the joint venture was formed, the St George name, the logo and the colours were locked into the joint venture agreement. And I think there was an assumption amongst fans, and I think amongst some officials too, that the history was locked in as well, but it wasn't formally locked in. And we now have a situation where some people are suggesting that the history of the club begins when the joint venture is signed, rather than, in my view, and I feel this so strongly, that it's when the foundation clubs are a part of the history of the club. I think anyone who, like me, I was on the hill in 77 and 79 when St George won the grand finals. There are people who go back to the grand finals of the 60s. They felt exactly the same way when St George Illawarra won the grand final in 2010. And they felt the St George fans of the 80s and 90s who lived through grand final defeats felt the same way in 1999 when St George Illawarra were defeated in the grand final. The history the St George and the Steelers live on in the St George Illawarra Dragons. And I very passionately believe that the history of the game, as it's recorded in statistical annuals and on websites and on logos, whatever, it needs to recognise that that history is part of the club. And St George Illawarra, or St George / St George Illawarra, have won 16 premierships. It's just a fact. And Illawarra / St George Illawarra have won one premiership. And it's, to me, it's just appalling that some people like to suggest that the history of St George prior to 1999 somehow isn't a part of the joint venture, because it is. And I honestly don't understand why people don't see that.
No, I agree. It just goes against common sense because, as you say, in the actual reality of being a fan of the club or playing for the club, you're part of that tradition, that living heritage. And it's nonsensical to say there's no connection between the clubs. Yeah, like you, I can't really understand why there is this official position about it, because nobody gains by it, and it's just a source of at least irritation to anybody who's either a fan of either club or interested in the history of the game. So,
yeah. I think anyone who followed St George prior to 1998 and still follows the Dragons today would be horrified if they knew that the club's quote official position is that the history of the Dragons begins in 1999.
Yeah,
I really struggle with that. I actually even struggle with it from a brand point of view, because all football clubs, all sporting clubs, are seeking some sort of advantage in what is a very competitive market. And St George Illawarra's greatest, the thing that sets St George Illawarra apart, is that spirit of the Red V that I write about over 300,000 words in two volumes. And it surprises me that the club chooses not to build that up as much as possible. And it also surprises me that the club, the Illawarra Steelers, had a lot of good qualities about them. And even though they didn't win a comp in their 17 years in the premiership, they produced some really fine players, and they played with a real grittiness that set them apart. And they are a part of the current Dragon story. And I think the club should play on that for all it's worth.
Yeah, absolutely. I could not agree more. And not least because it's such a successful merger. I mean, you want to pay tribute to those two traditions that have allowed both clubs to live on in the form that they have today. So, yeah, I think, I don't know. It's, you know, sometimes officials in the game don't necessarily act in the way that you'd want them to put it very diplomatically.
Yeah, and I think joint ventures will occur in professional sport across the world over the next, 10, 20, 50 years. The Australian Rugby League has this great opportunity to, if you like, set the benchmark, set the standard for how joint ventures work and how they look after their fans and how they incorporate their history. And I'm surprised that the NRL doesn't jump on this and say, this is what we're going to use the St George Illawarra Dragons as the example of how our code, our game, cherishes its history. Because if you don't cherish your history, I think you do so at your own peril. And I really think it's important that the game, and especially the Dragons, don't forget that.
Absolutely. And I think on those words of wisdom, we'll end it here. I'd say, thanks very much, Jeff Armstrong. It's been a wonderful pleasure talking to you, and it's also been a wonderful pleasure to read both volumes of The Spirit of the Red V. For listeners, I'll put a link on my website where you can buy the books, and I'll say thanks again to Jeff for providing the game with two fantastic volumes about a fantastic club, and for doing such a great interview. So until next time, thanks to Jeff, and thanks to listeners.